It's hot again.
I don't like this weather. This is not autumn. This autumn sucks. I'd like to have a refund. Thank you.
Yeah.
Weather gods. This is not cool. Literally. Not cool.
No. They gave us a teaser of what it could have been. And then it just
failed.
Today, nah.
Failed dismally. Epic fail, weather gods. I don't like it. It is, I don't know what degree it is, but it's so muggy. But yes.
Yeah.
A cyclone is just about to hit up north on Tuesday. Poor people. Stay safe, everyone.
And we'll be cool in a couple of weeks, but we'll talk about that at the end of the podcast, because we have reasons to mention specific things.
Do we?
I think we do, but that's okay. Let's just get on with it, shall we? So we can get out of this stuffy room.
All right, yes, it is our studio.
Woo! What the... History! Hello and welcome to What the History, your fortnightly taste of bizarre bits of history from us. I am one of your hosts, Trevor Holland.
And I'm Susie Holland. Susie Holland, yes, here I am, thank you.
Lovely, lovely, lovely. I will get the intro down pat at some point, but whatever.
Nah, I think we're famous for this now. Famous for something anyway.
Infamous?
Infamous?
Maybe. Anyway.
Okay.
Moving on. Susie, what do you have for us this fortnight?
Okay, well, a few weeks ago, loyal listeners, thank you, everyone and all, mwah, we love you, would have remembered my story I did on the world's worst actor, Robert Coates. Well, Trevor's actually found me another one, which I didn't even know existed, but I thought it sounded so great that I'd have to research it. This is about Maurice Flitcroft, the world's worst golfer. This guy's great. Okay, now, did you know, everyone, that golf was invented in the mid-15th century in Scotland? Yay! And then it was subsequently banned by royalty in 1457, as people would rather play golf and soccer as opposed to doing military training. Funny that. And it was re-banned again in 1470 and 1491, but most people ignored the ban and kept on playing. And it wasn't repealed until the Treaty of Glasgow in 1502. Well, lucky for golf enthusiasts, it was re-established as it took off as a sport all over the world and reached the interest of one Maurice Flitcroft, who never let a lack of talent stop him from going for the biggest prize in golfing at the time, the 1976 British Open. The fact that he had never played an entire game of golf or even had a handicap wasn't going to stop him either. Bless his little heart. He's a trier. Maurice came to the sport late when he was in his 40s and learned to play golf from reading an instruction manual written by English professional golfer Peter Ellis, which Maurice borrowed from the library. Now, he practiced doing his bunker shots in the local long jump pit in the athletic field and practiced putting into coffee cans buried in his backyard, and he ordered a set of clubs by mail order. Well, he's good, this one.
Mm-hmm.
I'm proud of him already. Now, in 1976, Maurice entered himself in the Open, but was soon met with a challenge. As an amateur, he needed to provide his handicap on the entry form. As he didn't have one, he simply wrote that he was a professional golfer. Yes. Luck was on his side as Maurice was accepted into the Open. Now, on the day of the first qualifying round, Maurice caught the suspicion of officials and fellow golfers when he teed off at the first hole. A guy called Jim Howard, he was a golfer who had been partnered with Maurice, noted, and I quote, "After gripping the club like he was intent on murdering someone, Flitcroft hoisted it straight up, came down vertically, and the ball travelled precisely 4 feet," end quote. The officials were absolutely furious, but no one could stop him after he had begun a game as per the gentlemanly rules. Now, Maurice's score on that day was 121, 49 over par, the worst score in the Open's history. Now, that's a pretty dubious honour. Now, the British press had an absolute field day with Maurice, with the headlines reading, "Gate Crasher of the Century, British Open Chump, Trickster Takes 121, read another. Maurice was achieving notoriety from his chosen sport and he lapped it up with gusto. So I think I would have done the same thing as well.
Raise it.
Why not? After the Open, Keith McKenzie, he was the secretary of the governing body of golf in Britain, called the Royal and Ancient, so that's probably a Scottish throwback as well, I was not happy that Morris had discovered the loophole, so he closed it and then banned Morris from participating in any golf tournaments ever again for bringing the noble sport into disrepute. Aww. Keith and the rest of the Royal Ancient thought that was the end of it. But Morris loved golf so much that he wasn't going to let a ban stop him. So after a hiatus, he applied for the Open again in 1984 under the pseudonym Gerald Hoppe, who posed as a Swiss professional golfer before Morris got taken off the green by officials. So he was forcibly taken off this time. In 1990, he tried again as Gene Paycheckie in tribute to the United States postal worker Walter Dinecki, who held the previous record for the worst round in Open history. So, yeah, it was nice playing tribute to the other guy. Mm-hmm. Morris, as Gene, made it two rounds before he got chased off the green by officials. And just the visual on that, some guy trying to play golf and, yeah, getting chased off as they worked out who he was. And when he was found out, usually by very bad playing, upset Royal and Ancient officials would chase him off the green, like I said. The upset that they had another Maurice Flitcroft on their hands, and they discovered it was actually the real Maurice Flitcroft. So they were not happy at all. Other noted pseudonyms Morris used to get into the Open were James Bojolly, an American professional, Arnold Palmtree, and wait for it, Count Manfred von Hofmeister. God. Oh, he's not going to go by halves at all. This guy's got my absolute vote. He attempted this way to get in another five times to enter the Open, but made it past only twice as the aforementioned Gerald Hoppe and Gene Paycheckie, thanks to the handwriting expert that Royal and Ancient employed to weed out any more entries by Morris. The times that Morris got through, though, he wore a disguise. So they, you know, they bundled him off the field, then took off his disguise, and they went, oh, God, it's you again. And now, by this stage, Morris's fame spread across the globe to the United States in Grand Rapids, Michigan, when in 1988 he was the guest of brothers Terry and Tim Moore, who decided Blythefield Country Club would be a good place to hold the inaugural Morris Gerald Flitcroft Member Guest Tournament, obviously named in his honour. And he also had various trophies named after him, usually for mistakes, mishaps, and poor playing. In 2010, Scott Murray and Simon Farnaby published a book on Morris's life called, again, wait for it, it's a scream, Phantom of the Open, Morris Flitcroft, the World's Worst Golfer. And Royal and Ancient apparently refused to discuss Morris, given that he had flouted their rules well into the 1990s. Way to go. Morris passed away in 2007, and before he died gave this quote in reference to the Royal and Ancient, and I quote, "I never set out to belittle them. Golf's just a game, and I tried my best. What did they need to get so uptight about?" End quote. Morris Flitcroft, I salute you. I'm proud of this guy.
That's glorious.
I love this guy. I like this guy better than Robert Coates. Now, you know, he got out. He knew that he wasn't that great, but he didn't let anything stop him. And I think that's a lesson for us all.
Absolutely.
Whether we're great or not. Go, Morris.
I'm just not too sure what the actual people who were good golfers who were partnered with him, how they might have been impacted by this.
They weren't happy at all. And there is a part of the story as well that one time when he did get taken off the ground, he was in his little golf cart with his caddy, which sometimes was his son, and the golf officials, the Royal and Ancient officials, would drive up in their caddy as well and actually block him from going forward and onto the green any further. So you could just imagine this. I reckon people, like with Robert Coates, would have rocked up just to see this performance.
Absolutely. I'm just imagining a car chase with golf carts on a golf course.
Oh, it's brilliant, this.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It's like Benny Hill. It's a bit like Benny
Hill. A bit like Benny Hill? I suppose.
He's awesome. Bless his little heart and rest in peace, Morris.
Good on you, Morris. Speaking of somebody else who has nothing to do, actually, with anything you just said.
Of course not.
I seriously have no segue. I can't force anything in here, so I may just continue on.
Yeah, go for it. We're doing something completely different here.
Yep,
no segues.
Susie did the recent one this time. I'm the one going further back.
All right, take it way back.
Okay, let's set the scene. Back.
Let's take everyone on a journey.
Well, before we go
peace, love, and mung beans. Woo.
Before we go back, let's just talk about more recent things. The screaming fans, people fainting, other people scrabbling for souvenirs, fans reaching out trying to just brush past the object of their attention. I'm sure we've all seen footage of the hordes waiting for the Beatles, heard stories of underwear being thrown at Tom Jones, and I'm sure we've all heard of the fan army known as the Beliebers.
Oh, dear.
Now, this sort of behaviour does seem a relatively modern phenomenon, but what would you say if I told you that an artist was getting this sort of reception back in the 1800s? Sorry, I didn't quite catch that. If you said, what the history, then you are correct.
I'd like to see what you did there. That's
right. Franz Liszt was born on October 22nd in 1811 in the village of Dobozhan. I think that's how it's pronounced.
Sorry to any Austrians. Yep. I just messed up one of your country's towns.
Yeah, because it was in the Austrian Empire. His father, Adam Liszt, was quite a prominent musician, proficient in piano, violin, cello, and guitar, and was also personally acquainted with the likes of Haydn, Hummel, and Beethoven.
This guy was already royalty.
Mm-hmm. So not surprisingly, Franz started learning to play piano by the time he turned 7. A bit more surprisingly was he had started composing by the time he turned 8 and performing in concerts by age 9. He showed so much promise that wealthy sponsors were offering to finance his further musical education in Vienna. Following his father's death in 1827, Franz took up teaching for a while to help support his mother, while continuing to develop his own music and style. By 1839, he was doing the unheard of. Before this, it was considered pretty poor form to play anything from memory on stage. It was almost considered arrogant. Franz changed this.
Good on, Franz.
He considered that playing the piano for an audience was more than just music, that it was a theatrical performance for the whole audience. He started his concerts by walking dramatically on stage from the wings. He had his piano angled so the audience could see his face before playing with extreme gusto, whipping his head around so his long hair would fly from his face, spraying beads of sweat into the audience, much like the more flamboyant piano players we know today.
Tim Minchin. Yay! Yeah.
And stories were spreading about how the crowd reacted to this energy, about the hysteria he was generating, particularly with his female fans. This reputation got cemented into history when he commenced a tour of Europe by playing a recital in Berlin in 1841. Reports included women fighting for his discarded gloves and handkerchiefs, broken piano strings were fashioned into bracelets, and even his coffee dregs were decanted into vials which were worn around the neck. According to one report listed in the book Franz Liszt, The Virtuoso Years by Alan Walker, quote, Liszt once threw away an old cigar stump in the street under the watchful eyes of an infatuated lady-in-waiting, who reverently picked the offensive weed out of the gutter, had it encased in a locket and surrounded with the monogram FL in diamonds, and went about her courtly duties unaware of the sickly odour it gave forth. End quote.
Lovely.
It was writer and poet Heinrich Heine that put a name to the frenzy inspired by Franz Liszt. In 1844, he wrote, in this rather lengthy quote, When formerly I heard of the fainting spells which broke out in Germany, and especially in Berlin, when Liszt showed himself there, I shrugged my shoulders pityingly and thought, Quiet Sabbatarian Germany does not wish to lose the opportunity of getting the little necessary exercise permitted it. In their case, thought I, it is a matter of the spectacle for the spectacle's sake. Thus I explained this Listomania, and looked on it as a sign of the politically unfree conditions existing beyond the Rhine. Yet I was mistaken. After all, and I did not notice until last week at the Italian Opera House where Liszt gave his first concert, this was truly no Germanically sentimentalizing Berlinet audience before which Liszt played quite alone, or rather accompanied solely by his genius, and yet how convulsively his mere appearance affected them. How boisterous was the applause which rang to meet him.
Well done, Trev. Whew. Well done.
End quote. Thank goodness. The results of this Listomania was so profound and the hysteria surrounding his performances so great that some even considered it an infectious disease of some kind and that medical treatment may be required.
Freud would have had a field day.
Mm-hmm. Listomania burnt out rather quickly. When Franz returned to places of great success, the concert attendances were much lower. The belief is that much of his audience were a bit embarrassed by their previous behaviour. Franz ultimately distanced himself from the craze named after him. After the death of his son and daughter, and a thwarted attempt to marry later in life, apparently the lady had not been officially divorced from her previous husband, he retired to a monastery near Rome in 1863. He never stopped composing, though, and in 1875 helped to establish the Royal Academy of Music at Budapest. Franz Liszt passed away at the age of 74 in 1886 from pneumonia, leaving behind a legacy of music that still inspires performers today. The likes of Billy Joe, Elton John, Tori Amos, Tim Minchin.
Yay!
Insert any flamboyant pianist you like, are reminiscent of the style that Franz pioneered. In 1975, film director Ken Russell created a rather bawdy rock opera called Listomania, where Who lead singer Roger Daltrey played the famous composer. And in 2009, indie rock band Phoenix released their single, Listomania, which reached number 5 on the US Billboard charts.
I love that song.
It is safe to refer to Franz Liszt as a pioneer of musical performance, but I can imagine all those who simply didn't get Listomania shaking their heads and asking, what the history?
Absolutely. That was great. Yeah, I really like Franz.
Yeah,
I like his piano playing and his flamboyancy. And
I just thought of a segue I could have used from one person who bucked the trend and did things that weren't done the way they were meant to be.
Yes.
We moved on to this person who did the same.
Yes, both trend buckers.
Trend bucker.
Doesn't make sense. That's just awful.
I blame the heat.
I blame the heat. Is that rain I hear?
No, that's a pool filter.
Oh, bugger. And
on that note,
I got excited.
Thank you very much for listening to What the History. Now, all our references are down below if you want to click through and find out more. I did leave out quite a lot of Franz Liszt's life.
Yeah.
Try saying that's that the past.
you can't either.
Because he basically would probably be a 45 to an hour podcast in himself. Also, just so you are aware, we are taking a short break after this podcast. Yes. Susie and I, let's just say we've got a little 20th anniversary coming up.
Yay!
Woo-hoo! So we're actually heading OS to celebrate in style. So it's going to be about a month to the next podcast, but I'm sure you guys can hold out. And if you are a new listener, check out all the back episodes at wth.rufusproject.com.
Ha-ha! Hashtag!
Hashtag WTHpod is another thing you can search for. Or find What the History on Facebook, the What the History podcast page, or go to pod_what on Twitter.
That's right. And if I just want, I just want to mention one more thing about that Listomania movie. Isn't there a Rocky Horror picture show sort of influence on that?
I'll save that if I do Listomania for the Rufus Project podcast, which you should also totally listen to.
Ah, yes. I see what we did there.
Yes. particularly the last one about Flash Gordon, which also featured Susie here as a guest.
I love Flash.
And if you don't want to do any of the other things I mentioned, you can also get in touch with us. This is a very messy closeout. By sending an email to wthpod@rufusproject.com. We would love to hear from you. And please rate and review us on iTunes. Yay!
Yeah, that would be great. That would be great. Thank you, everyone, so much for listening.
Yes. So, until next time, we'll be back in about 4 weeks' time with more bizarre bits of history to make you say,
what the history?
Farewell.
Good night, everyone. Bye. A list of mania. Think less but see it grow. Like a ride, oh. Not easily offended. Not let it go.